Category E5, sports broadcaster, Jer Gilroy.
It is this incredible thing where, you know, you have this amazing season, score all these goals, and then at some point they reintroduce the idea, well, actually, he's not getting on very well in Juventus, and so we can buy him back cheap. Ian Rush is coming back. What are you thinking at that stage?
I can't say it on the radio. I wasn't happy, obviously, because I thought, you know, winning the Golden Boot that year and winning the league, and I knew Rushy comes, you know, it's going to be difficult. It's always 4-4-2. Whereas this day and age, you've got to have three really good strikers. It's changed the game, you know, you've got to rotate as such. And in them days, you didn't. You play all the games. So I knew the fight was on, but I was always up for a fight. It didn't matter, you know, Rushy come back. You know, I was never going to lie down. And I proved that, I proved that that season, because I scored 31 goals and Ian only got about 12. So job done for me, but it wasn't good enough for Kenny.
Could you get on with Ian Rush under those circumstances?
Of course.
It's not his fault. You don't blame him.
Absolutely not. We're still good friends now. We always have been. But, you know, and Peter, it's just probably Kenny, who I felt let me down in the end. You know, if you scored 31 goals in a season, you know, it's, for me, it's crazy to let anyone go. Even though I was 29, knocking on 30, I was, you know, fit as a fiddle.
Well, it's not like you don't go on and play for another 8 years or 10 years.
Yeah. So I have to say, I was really aggrieved. And in particular, I'm honest, when I went to Spain, I actually wanted Liverpool to lose a few games. I was really so peeved. I can't say the word. Can I?
You can say whatever you want.
I was pissed off. All right, fellas.
Did you forgive Kenny for that eventually, or is it?
No, it's something that I really can't forgive. You know, I still talk to Kenny, of course I do that, but I just cannot forgive that, because I don't see the common sense. It's like Man United letting Rooney go, or, you know, Van Persie getting let go, and he brought Ronnie Rosenthal in. Fair enough, Ronnie was a decent player, but, you know, he didn't score many goals. So, yeah, it's just something that's always played on my mind. You've got to move on. But it's something that really, over the years, all I ever wanted to do was play for Liverpool Football Club. It's like getting a Christmas present and it's getting took off you at Easter. You know, and you've scored 64 goals in 103 games, whatever that be. You've done everything that's been asked for you. And then, you know, you're disregarded.
Do you get stopped on the street by Irish cycling fans? Because I've got to say, I mean, men of a certain age, I'm 34, I remember queuing up for hours to watch the Nissan International Classic when it would come to town, and the Tour de France, the ones that you competed in, and obviously with Kelly and Roach, they got wall-to-wall coverage here.
Yeah, I'm a little bit older. I haven't been into the cycling world extensively in the last 10 years, so... Occasionally I do. Yeah, I think if I'm at a race or close to an event, I do. But, you know, I've aged. I'm not in my 20s anymore. So.
I don't know. I've seen pictures. You're still pretty fresh-faced.
No, a little pudgy.
You obviously still enjoy getting on the bike, though.
I do, yeah. I wish I could. I do ride. I wish I could ride a little bit more, but I have issues with lead pellets in me that I was shot in 1987 on a hunting accident. So I still have problems from that. I ride a lot and I get my blood lead levels go up fairly high. Lead is basically toxic, but it's like three times as high as it should be.
I was going to ask you about your first Tour de France win before I asked you about the hunting accident, but since you've brought it up, I mean, what an incredible story for anybody to go through and to come back from.
Yeah, it's I look back and I was fairly naive. You know, I listened to my surgeon and said, oh, you'll be fine. She meant, yeah, you'll live. You won't have, you didn't lose one lung and you're still pumping. But I took that literally, I'll be fine. And I started trying to train 2 months later and it was just insanity. I went from 150 pounds US to 121 pounds and lost 70% of my blood volume. So, and I just figured all I have to do is train, but it was about 2 years of up and down and struggling. But I came out of it about 2 years after that and won my second Tour de France, but never felt the same since. So
it's so incredible that most people, you kind of think about going through a life-changing event like that, they would put the feet up, relax, maybe travel the world a bit, see some things they haven't seen. But you wanted to get right back on the bike almost immediately.
Yeah, because I was shot right mid-career. I mean, I still had, and that happened 8 years later, kind of maybe burned out from the sport, but it happened just as I was getting into the sweet spot, so it was very hard. I mean, I considered quitting for a couple of years there. I mean, it was very hard to go from being one of the top riders to being one of the last riders in the group. So it tested me mentally. I don't know. Sometimes it did cause permanent damage. So.
As far as I know, it was your brother-in-law who actually discharged the shot. Does that make Christmas dinner interesting sometimes?
Yeah, unfortunately for me, though. Now, my sister's husband, they divorced about 10 years ago, although it wasn't, he had nothing to do with it. That was an accident. So it's, no, even then, I had no problem with it. It was, how can you have a problem with an accident?
Of course. Do you remember the immediate aftermath of it? Were there moments of clarity where you thought, yeah, I'm going to get back on the bike really soon? Or were your thought processes just a bit too jumbled at that stage?
Well, I got shot and I was waiting for an ambulance, which never came. I was fortunate there was a helicopter, but I just kind of remember getting on that and just kind of fading off. And then landing, then I had a chest tube pumped in me. And then the next 3 days, my wife saw me hanging in like a hammock, just dripping blood everywhere. So, and I came out about 2 days later where I was conscious, but pretty vague. I had a lot of pain, and I would say I started really coming around about 6 weeks later. And then I was just given a letter of a very sweet letter from the French team I was on. Basically, oh, Cher Greg, we loved our time together, cherished the moments, but you're fired.
Oh, wow.
So I just got shot, I got told I was fired, so I was kind of in limbo there, and it set me off on a pace of trying to get on a team that would only take me if I raced again that year, and I ended up racing the Tour of Ireland, and 5 months after that, and I'm even shocked when I think I got around 37th or 38th, but it was good. It was a stressful period, but you know, life is full of stress. Nothing comes easy.
Full-time whistle has just gone, blown by Howard Webb. It's finished. Sunderland 0, Manchester United 1. An agonising couple of minutes remaining for the Manchester United players, fans and management here at the Stadium of Light.
Yeah, I don't know if it's going to be too agonising, Dave. There are 100 seconds left for Manchester City to pull something out against QPR. It's taken them so long so far in the second half to get the chances that they need. Oh, it's a goal! It's Aguero! Kevin Gilman!
This is incredible! Absolutely incredible! The ball breaks to Aguero on the right wing and he just smashes it past Paddy Kenny. I mean, the QPR defence has deflated. They're on the floor. The Man City bench are all on the pitch. Joe Hart's running to the crowd on his own. Everyone's just all over the place. The City fans have erupted. The last 2 minutes of this game is incredible. Absolutely incredible.
How did it happen?
Man City just carried the ball further and further up the pitch. De Jong had a shot from the edge of the box. The QPR defence blocked the shot. The ball then broke to Aguero on the just inside the box on the right-hand side. He had a free strike at goal and he just smashed it past Paddy Kenny. And it looks like he's game over. It looks like this is Man City's title now.
This is the greatest thing that's ever happened in football.
Well, all the Man City supporters are just walking out. They're all around me now. They're literally walking out the stadium. That's it. 2 minutes to go. That's it. The season's over with. And then Aguero, he skipped past the challenge into the box and then smashed it past him. A lady walked past me about 2 minutes ago in tears, floods of tears, walking out of the stadium. That was it. Man City's season's over with then. And now all of a sudden, it's game over. And that's it. Man City's title. I'm sure of it now.
It's Man City 3, Queen's Park Rangers 2. They're still playing. They're not playing anymore at the Stadium of Light. Presumably, Dave, the news has filtered through.
Oh, hazard watcher. All of the Sunderland fans are doing the Manchester City Poznan celebration, all bouncing with their backs to the Manchester United away support. It was incredible for the second time this afternoon. It's like a bomb had hit the Stadium of Light as the Manchester United...
Dave, Kevin Kilman, Manchester City are the champions.
Absolutely amazing. The Man City fans are just strolling onto the pitch now. There's thousands of them. What a wonderful occasion this is for the Man City supporters. 5 minutes before the end of the game, it's game over. They've not won the title. That's it. And as ever in typical Manchester City fashion, they leave it till the death. It's never straightforward with Man City. And you have to say, it's just amazing. Absolutely amazing.
how difficult was it to maintain your basketball career and a drug habit at the same time? It seems like these two things just can't coalesce at all. And yet, again, in the documentary, there's this amazing footage of a game, I think it's against UMass, where you've been up all night caning it and go out and play an absolutely amazing game, draining shots, driving to the basket, just playing brilliantly. And it seemed as if you could maybe, in your own mind, accommodate the lifestyle and playing to a very high level for a period of time.
You know, you think you can, you know, and I got lucky that night. And that's the part of the documentary that I absolutely despise. Because in reality, I should have went into that game and probably dropped on the court, you know, of a heart attack. No, that's what, you know, really at the end of the day should happen. Not go out there and get the MVP of the game and score a bunch of points. You know, I don't want to get anybody, I don't want to send any mixed messages here. People say, well, you know, you made it to the pros. That's okay. I made it to the pros, but once I jumped into heroin and OxyContin, my career started in Denver and ended in Tehran, Iran. You know, it was a rapid descent from year to year. My price tag and my location severely, severely dropped, and my career fell off.
What was it like living in Tehran? You were still obviously addicted in Tehran. How did you source drugs in Tehran? It seems like it's... You know, it must be an incredibly difficult thing to do.
Oh, it was. I mean, it was like the underground tunnel. You know, I found a taxi cab driver that was willing to come by my house every night at around 2 a.m. when everybody was sleeping. He'd park outside my house. He'd call me. I'd go to my window. I'd drop the money and he'd throw it back up to my room. He'd jump in his taxi and take off. You know, you can find drugs everywhere. You know, every country I played in, China, Italy, Turkey, Warsaw, Tehran, there's drugs on every street if you want to get to that street, you know, and you're willing to take the chance. You know, one thing I found out, people would always tell me, oh, you got to get out of Fall River. Fall River is a tough blue-collar town, and they'd say, you know, Fall River's your downfall. Fall River wasn't my downfall. I was my downfall, you know, because I'm in Fall River quite a bit nowadays, and I'm not getting high. You know, until I fix myself, I could be nowhere. I could be nowhere without being high.
Did you still enjoy playing basketball when you were in China and Turkey and in Tehran, or at that stage had it become simply a way of accessing money to access drugs?
It was all about accessing money to access drugs. It was harder than playing professional basketball. You know, I was a professional junkie. You know, my mind, my body, my soul was consumed every day by drugs.
Even when you get to the NBA and you end up at the Celtics, by that stage, probably because you were already on drugs, maybe that could have been something you would have enjoyed if you hadn't already been addicted.
Of course. I mean, I can cherish those moments now. You know, I can look back at wearing a Celtics jersey and being a local kid who made it to that level. I can appreciate that now. I couldn't appreciate that then. I was worried where my dope dealer was. You know, I was always 6 hours ahead of myself. How can you cherish the moment you're in when you're always 6 hours ahead of yourself? I was always making plans for the next move. You know, I wasn't thinking about the game, the practice, you know, putting on a jersey. I was always making sure if my drug dealer was going to be at the game, after the game. I mean, it's constant chaos. You know, it's living 6 hours at a time. It's misery.
It's really unbelievable to think that you could continue to play and to be an addict like this. And then, I guess, Chris, the most important thing is to stress that You managed to claw a way out from all of this. At the same time, you've clawed a way out and clawed a way back now where you're able to sit and talk to us here in Ireland and as you've done all across the United States to tell your story.
You know, I'm still clawing back. You know, there is no end game to recovery. You know what I mean? There is no come back. Just still come and come every day, you know? And that's how I look at it. You know, it was either... die, go to jail, or live. I mean, it's that simple. And thank God I had angels above who were willing to help and help me see the light. And, you know, I'm still clawing. Trust me, I claw every day. And people look at me now and they say, oh, you poor thing, you're going to have to deal with this for the rest of your life. And I look at them and I say, poor thing. I was a poor thing 4 years ago. Don't look at me now with sympathy. You know, this is a life second to none I'm living. You know, there was a time in my life I woke up every morning, hostage, prisoner. And now I wake up with with the utmost, you know, dignity, pride, self-esteem, and say, let's go, let's take another day.
Well, we've been here all afternoon, and really the Heineken Cup final has not disappointed. A brilliant performance from Leinster, crowning them champions of Europe for the third time in 4 years. They've won 42-14, tries from O'Brien, Healy, Van der Merwe, a penalty try, and Sean Cronin really wrapping up a comprehensive victory. We still have Keith Wood and Liam Tolan with us, but let's get the full-time thoughts of Eddie O'Sullivan and Tommy Bogue. Tommy, really disappointment for Ulster, but no shame in losing to possibly one of the greatest sports teams in any sport that we've seen almost in history.
Yeah, Leinster today just shows what a clinical side, what a top side they are. To win it back-to-back in the last 2 years, to win it the third time in 4 years, just shows what a great side they are. And even going forward, you have to, you know, there's a lot of young guys coming through there. They've still got a couple of great years ahead. So I think that, you know, there's no shame in Ulster. They fought so well today. I think that the scoreline maybe flatters Leinster a little bit, but I think it was a great game of rugby, and, you know, outstanding support here from both sides as well.
Yeah, really outstanding support. Just the last 10 minutes when the game was gone, from the Ulster fans just stood up, started singing and waving their flags. And maybe teams need to go through some of this. Maybe this is part of the development for the squad.
Yeah, I mean, there's a sense of that, you know, you probably have to lose one to really feel the pain of it and then appreciate when you win one. But you have to say Ulster gave everything they had today, but Leinster were just too polished, too many shots in their gun, you know. And you felt, well, Leinster, even when Ulster scored, Leinster had all the capacity to come back, and they did. No, I do think the scoreline is dreadfully cruel to Ulster. I thought it, you know, 28-14, I thought, you don't know if that's a reasonable scoreline, but 42-14 does not tell the story of the game. And you really feel sorry for the Ulster boys. They really put their bodies on the line. They really put it out there, but they just hadn't the horsepower to win it. And the scoreline does not reflect the effort they put in.
Keith, we were talking before the game. Shane Horgan brought up the Green Bay Packers of Vince Lombardi. I'm thinking of Chicago Bulls of Michael Jordan. I'm thinking of Pep Guardiola's Barcelona. That's the level that this team are operating at the moment.
Well, I thought they were absolutely fantastic. I do think that Joe Smith has done an incredible job in building the squad and making them feel incredibly comfortable. And you know, sometimes when you're playing and you see one of the subs come on, you'd say, oh God, you know, that's not happening here. You know, there's a view on, oh, there's fresh legs coming on. There's guys we trust coming onto the field. And they bring different things to the manner in which, and Leinster changed their style of play depending on who has been brought on at different times. They do it at 9, they've done it at 10 today. You know, they've just had a little bit of a different cut at it. But their forwards were phenomenal today. And it just seemed to be, you know, preordained as this season went along. They grew. They put a consummate performance today. And, like, to be honest, to put 42 points on an Ulster side that played in the manner in which they did, I mean, yeah, Ulster has to be incredibly proud for the way they've done it. It is harsh, it is unfair when you look at the scoreline, but they put a huge amount into it. They made a few mistakes, they may have had a couple of mistakes in selection, made it a little bit hard for themselves, but ultimately they got wiped by a team that is on the top of the game, knowing how to win big cup matches.
Tommy, you'll obviously be part of that Ulster squad next year. I mean, I don't want to ask you how painful this is, but I kind of do want to ask you just how painful this is.
Oh, it's very difficult. It would have been very difficult for me either way. If they had a won today, I would have been absolutely devastated. But at the same time, I was willing them on the whole match. You know, it's very difficult for them. But again, I think, you know, Leinster have been in this situation. I think they've lost a final. Munster lost the final before they went in through and went on to win. I think every team has to see what the hurt feels like to try and spur them on, to know what it's like to play in this sort of arena. And, you know, I think going forward, looking at the support here, if they can keep this going next year and the year after that, it's just going to spur them on more and more.
News Talk 106 to 108.